Hey guys, welcome to episode 2 of Pushing the F***ing Envelope. In this episode, we'll be covering ARP instruments, and in particular, the ARP 2600. Hey guys, this is Trent. We're going to talk about the ARP 2600. The ARP 2600 is a semi-modular monophonic patch cable synthesizer, which was designed by Alan Perlman and manufactured by ARP Instruments in the early 70s. Unlike other modular systems at the time, in which you had to pick and choose modules, then wire together, the ARP 2600 came out with a fixed selection of basic synth sounds internally pre-wired. You could also create amazing analog sounds because it had built-in spring reverb, amp, and stereo speakers. The weird thing about the ARP 2600 is that they had different incarnations. The first version that came out in the early 70s was the Blue Marvin, aka the Blue Meanie. Then the ARP settled with a more portable version with a handle that had a gray face, and this was the classic version of the 2600. Each variation of the 2600 sounds a little different. A lot of people say as they became more serviceable, the quality of sound deteriorated, especially the models after 1972. The best sounding ARP 2600s are supposed to be the oldest ones.
Thanks, Trent. Great introduction. And now we're going to move on with a section that I like to call Live Free, Die ARP.
So what's going on, Dan?
You know, this and that, Pinger.
Yeah.
What's going down with you? What you got to talk to me about?
We are going to talk about a little bit of the background of ARP instruments, how it all came to be, you know what I mean?
Sounds like a sensible place to start, Adam.
Yeah, I guess so. If you really want to understand the company, you have to understand where it came from. So ARP is an acronym named after its inventor, Alan Robert Perlman.
Good guy.
He was an engineer by trade, actually.
Similar to Bob Moog,
only I would say a little bit more reputable.
Right.
Bob.
You just got cussed.
I know. My bad, but you didn't work on amplifiers for the NASA space program.
That's true.
Yeah. Perlman worked on the Apollo and Gemini space programs, which is pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, right. Anyway, yeah. So he's an engineer. He went to Worcester Polytechnic.
Yeah.
Got his degrees, PhDs, and all the rest of it through that. When he was at university, he was into the electronic music, or at least the idea of electronic music. He understood that it was an industry that could be really big, mm-hmm. but because no one was really achieving what he thought, realizing the potential he thought the industry had,
yeah.
he kind of like waved away from that.
And he founded that other company or something.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. So he took his engineering knowledge and formed Nexus Research.
Yeah, that's right.
That's the kind of stuff that he was working on NASA. You know, with he was inventing like amplifiers and stuff,
building amplifiers, analog synthesizer components or something like that.
Yeah, but I don't think there were synthesizer things. It was kind of like, you know, amplifiers in an electronic
modules or
sense.
Yeah.
But then in 1968, and we talked about this in the Moog episode, 1968, this album called Switched on Bach dropped.
Right. Wendy Carlos, right?
Carlos? Well,
Wendy Carlos?
It's actually both. It's Wendy and Walter. At the time of recording, it was Walter. I think
Oh,
now,
seriously?
Yeah.
So when Walter became Wendy.
That's right. They're one and the same, but not at the same time.
Blows your mind.
It takes all sorts. Switched on Bach, switched him on to electronic music again.
I like that.
I've been thinking about that for a long time.
Yeah.
You can tell, can't you? Anyway, he got back into the idea and he was like, I want to make something similar to what Moog is doing. Mm-hmm. But he kind of thought he could do a bit better. And so when Moog had released the big modular Moog and was just about to release the mini Moog.
Yeah, that was about like 67 or something.
So it's just coming up to the 70s when the mini Moog dropped in 1970. So on the lead up to that, ARP was developing their huge modular synth called the there were a couple of different like prototypes, and then the first commercially released one was the ARP 2500.
Right.
And if you see pictures of it, it's just enormous.
It's massive,
like,
right?
Yeah, it's like, you know, like it's like NASA. It's like
Command.
Yeah, it's like Houston.
Well, like the center module held like 12 different modules, sorry. And there were two wings on the side of it that held six each or something. So this thing is just ridiculous.
It's huge, and it's thousands of thousands of dollars. And but you'll have probably heard it. Apparently, they didn't make very many. I heard somewhere that there was only 100 even ever made. But you'll have heard it on The Who, like the records by The Who. I think Stevie Wonder had one.
Was that the 2600 on Stevie Wonder's? Stevie Wonder played a bunch of ARPs, though, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's definitely on The Who, one of the big ones that's probably a CSI theme of some sort. And, Led Zeppelin had one later into their career.
Well, like, I mean, have you ever seen Close Encounters of the First Kind?
Third Kind.
I've never seen Who. Third Kind, yeah,
some
exactly.
Kind. Close Encounters of some kind. Yeah.
Of some kind.
That's an ARP 25. That's the 2500?
That's the 2500. They apparently you couldn't talk to aliens unless 2500 was invented.
Well, think of that as that's a landmark moment in both music
and civilization.
Science fiction, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. So, yeah, Spielberg, he decided to use the 2500. And one of the interesting things about that was that the guy that went to go and set up the 2500 for the production, they were just like, all right, well, we need somebody to actually operate this thing. So the guy that you see in the movie that's playing, it's not, you don't actually see it as an ARP 2500. I think it's just a keyboard or something like that.
Something sciencey.
But like, yeah, that was the technician that was actually just sent over by ARP to go.
Oh, really?
Set
He's like
up
an ARP
the,
rep.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. And they just like put him in the movie, which is pretty sweet.
Nice. That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So so the 2500 up and running, but then what happened was, as the 2500 was out, and like we said, it was massive, Moog kind of came out with the Mini Moog, and their modular thing was like a lot smaller than the ARP. So the ARP 2500 really suffered from being essentially immobile. Like, you just couldn't take it on the road. So ARP developed a smaller version of this. Tried to wean everything they had down into a more manageable
package.
Make it
a little bit more portable.
Yeah, right. And they came up with the 2600.
Yeah.
It's a bit smaller. It's still a modular thing, so it's not as small as the Mini Moog, but a lot more mobile. And they built a lot of stuff into it from the 2500, but it was more affordable, and just generally you could take it on the road, and that's a big deal.
That's the beauty of it, right?
Yeah,
totally. And I mean, in those days as well, after the success of Switched on Bach, Moog was kind of the go-to for analog synths.
Yeah,
like they got a lot of press for that, and a lot of people were saying, like, you know, I want the Moog. So, you know, in response to that, ARP was really the biggest kind of competitor to them. So they really needed to kind of come up.
They did actually, like in the late 70s, they actually surpassed the Moog. They were outselling Moog.
Seriously?
Yeah, which, you know, you think of Moog as being the classic thing.
Yeah.
But actually, ARP, at some point, at the peak of their career, was outselling Moog. But anyway, we had to move on to the next section. So this is a section where we sent our boy Nick out into the field, and he interviewed a man called Don Garbutt, who is
phenomenal.
Yeah, he's a great man. He knows everything about... You could drop any name of synth. You could probably even drop like the kind of production number of it, and he would know what it is. He knows everything about synths. Nick was lucky enough to interview him and talk to him about the ARP 2600 and the family of ARP. So let's go with that.
And during his interview, Don gave us a little taste of what the ARP 2600 can do. Check it out.
Yeah, I guess for the past 6 years or so, I've been kind of devoting my recreational composition to writing pieces about theoretical physics, trying to tie together ideas of emergent new ideas about how the universe works, Big Bang, alternative Big Bang theories, and that sort of thing. Quantum mechanics, cosmology, that's the stuff that interests me. And so I make music to deliver the scientific concepts as entertainment, which it isn't to a lot of people. And that's why I'm pretty alone in my field.
Hey guys, this is Nick, and I am here with a very special guest. If you could please tell me who you are and what exactly you do.
Hey Nick, this is Don Garbutt. I'm a specialist in ancient analog electronic equipment, because I'm an ancient guy, and I am the original owner of this fine ARP 2600 device here that we have. This is an ARP special, I hear. Is that right?
That is correct. So I'm going to lead off with what really intrigued you about electronic music? What made you get into it?
Well, I guess the start point was Switched on Bach by Walter Carlos. And that was probably the turning point in my life, because I was just a young kid and I heard that album and I saw the picture of this incredibly huge musical instrument with all kinds of knobs and cables sticking out of it. And the sounds of the Moog at the time, that was in the late 60s, it had a sound to it that was brand new. So those instruments were new. There was electronic music from Europe and from some of the avant-garde composers, experimental composers that had used electronics throughout the 20th century, but this was pop music in a sense, because it was on the Billboard chart, even though it was classical music done by Walter Carlos, but it was accessible. So that album was a great stimulus to me and made me want to follow the path to getting involved with electronic music and even computer music in the early days. Also, I was in a rock band, and our keyboard player, I was the bass player, our keyboard player in the early 70s, had an ARP Odyssey, and he wouldn't let me play it because I had greasy fingers, and he didn't like my greasy fingers on his keyboard. So it was this sort of pressure cooker scene where I just was dying to tinker with this instrument, and he was being a real sort of hardliner, not letting me monkey with it in case I broke it. But you know, these things are pretty durable. My ARP has lasted since 1976, still running fine.
What intrigued you about the ARP? What did it have that other things didn't have? Why would you buy it opposed to something just as popular at the time?
Well, the ARP was a lot more affordable and yet was a good sounding synth. So the filter had a good sound to it. The patchability would enable you to be able to work for days and weeks and months without feeling like you've heard the same sound twice. Now, it was actually a little bit difficult to get the same sound twice because it didn't have any programmability, and you'd have to tune the oscillators, and it's basically a totally real-time, hands-on machine. But the thing about the ARP was everything was patchable, so you could connect things in ways that were even wrong sort of scientifically, but come up with some pretty bizarre sounds as a result. And the thing about the ARP was it fell into a nice price bracket, in the sense of $4,000 was cheap compared to the other modules. Like, I also used the ARP 2500 up at York University, and it was a $30,000 instrument. And we had the $30,000 main bank and a couple of wing cabinets with more modules. So they probably had invested about $60,000 into the ARP 2500, but it wasn't portable, and it was I was just a greenhorn at the time, so I didn't really get access to the studios. Like, I was so eager to want to do something when I got to York University in my first couple of years that I didn't really know what I was doing. So my first night in the studio there running the 2500, I spent 8 hours unable to actually get a sound out of the thing. It was extremely frustrating. To get anything really complex in terms of a modular synthesizer, you'd have to spend at least $40,000 to get up and running with the Moog modular in the day. And so the ARP 2600 was kind of the entry point, because it was $4,000. And for $4,000, you got an instrument that it had three oscillators, a filter, mixer, ring modulator, a couple of envelope generators, spring reverb, built-in speakers, and a handle. So you could actually, it was portable, even though it's the size of a large fridge. But it was still, at the time, I would use it both in the studio. I actually had three of them at one point, because running with sequencers driving the analog machines, you could get a lot of interesting stuff going if you had a lot of modules. So I had an 8-track tape recorder, and I used to use timed click pulses on one of the tracks, on the 8th track of the tape, to drive my sequencers so that I could get a bunch of sequencers driving a bunch of ARPs and some other equipment as well. I had some Roland System 100 modular stuff and the Oberheim SEM module. And anything that I could rent from Longham Equades to supplement my gear. And that you could get an enormous amount of stuff going, all synchronized and running together from the click pulses from the tape track. And then once you recorded some stuff on a couple of tracks, then you could use the click pulses again to run more sequencer stuff and record more stuff on more tape tracks, all tightly locked together from this string of click pulses that actually emanated from my drum machine at the time, the Korg KR55 module. And that was my format in the around the 1976 to 1980 time frame.
Okay, that's great. You mentioned the Odyssey and the 2500. So obviously you know ARP instruments very well. What are your impressions of the other products as opposed to the 2600?
Well, each one's a little different. Even the 2600, there were a few different versions of the 2600. The one called the Blue Mini was, I think, the first one. Then there was the gray panel, and then there was a bit of a legal problem, because there was a copyright on the Moog filter, which Arnold R. Perlman, that's ARP, A-R-P, Arnold R. Perlman, had apparently built his filter too close to the specs of the Moog filter and was told to change his filter or be in a really nasty legal battle. So he changed his filter just before the orange panel version came out. And so it sounded a little different. There was a little less high frequency response in the orange panel version. It actually lops off at about 14 kilohertz in the top end. So it's kind of missing a little bit of the sparkle and the real high frequency air part of the sound that you get from the gray panel or the Blue Mini. But each ARP has a slightly different sound to it. The ARP Odyssey is great for live usage. People like Chick Corea used the ARP Odyssey, and Joe Zawinul used it in Weather Report, and it was a great solo instrument. But all these instruments are not polyphonic. None of the ARPs, none of the Odyssey or the 2500, none of them would allow you to play a chord on it. So to make a chord, basically, to make a three-note chord, you needed to have three ARPs.
I know you said earlier that you've produced some people and some pretty successful acts in Canada. Do you use your ARP in music, past and present? And you know, what do you think it's suited for the best?
Well, most of my work now is doing music production using the sort of wide palette of virtual instruments inside the computer. Even though I do have some vocal techniques for playing robotic voices out of another particular instrument made by Roland. But other than that, the convenience of having your studio in your laptop is definitely an advantage. But the thing with the ARP is I still use it when it comes to improvising, when it comes to something that is a live performance with electronics, then the ARP is a brilliant thing to have, and I never get tired of playing it. It's the kind of thing that I've used it in a few productions. It was actually when I was in Britain, this is quite a while ago, but there's a girl band called Girl School. They're sort of like a female equivalent of Motorhead, and I got hooked up with them as the studio engineer had called me to say that the producer of that project was Jim Lee, the bass player of a band called Slade. So I don't know, it's going way back there, but Slade were kind of like a power, you know, sort of power rock, power ballad, but hard rock kind of ensemble in Britain. The producer needed explosion sounds in a Girl School track. And so the engineer at the studio had suggested that they have me come in with my ARP and make some explosion sounds. So I came in and that did something like... sort of something like that. I don't know, I'm just kind of winging it here, but... kind of hear the... that, right? So you, I don't know if you can hear that. It's kind of like noise generator blasts. But that was one of my first gigs in Britain as a studio musician to make explosions. And then they found that I actually had musical talent beyond just blowing things up. And so that that's going back a ways. But since then, I have tried to keep a sort of an edge on the technology so that you have something that other people want. And as a session musician, that's what got me hooked up with people like Oscar Peterson, for instance, who was quite an adventurous and techno-savvy individual. He was always looking for an ultimate workstation that could do everything and that he could carry into a hotel room. Now, other musical jobs that I've done recently, again, I guess the ARP is, it does factor in, not really in a big way, but it's not so much getting used in my commercial work with other artists as for my own personal work. And so recently I did a piece that you can see my kind of low-budget video that I threw together for it, but the music was actually took quite a while to produce a piece, again, in the theoretical physics domain called the Higgs field. Higgs field, its associated particle is the Higgs boson, but I made a piece about the Higgs field. It's on my website at dongarbutt.com, and it's on my YouTube channel. And that piece, every sound was made on the ARP 2600. Even though I only did it just a couple of years ago, I thought it would be an interesting expedition to go back to the early days of only having a monophonic instrument and working with multiple tracks of the digital recording system, and also working with an interactive piece of software that you could kind of you could jam with this software. It's a program called M by Cycling 74. And so M was sort of like some additional muscle power that I had working with. I had M playing the ARP, sending it note events while I had my hands free to be able to manipulate the controls on the ARP. So it's almost like you're jamming with yourself, even though M is much more than a sequencer. It's kind of like a note pattern generator that has a lot of random capability to it. So it was able to run these sort of semi-organized but slightly randomized note patterns to the ARP, while I was able to have both hands free to tweak the controls on the ARP while I was playing. And each operation of producing a musical line with this technique would result in a musical line that I would improvise and record into audio. As the piece started to take shape, ended up having an enormous number of tracks all playing. And interesting enough, it's also mixed with 3D sound. And so the individual tracks are imaged in a simulated 3D sound space. So if you listen with headphones, you'll have a much more excellent experience in hearing the sound imaging, as the sounds are kind of liberated from just a stereo playback, and you'll get the illusion of sounds actually moving around behind your head and up and down, that sort of thing. So that's another topic, but it is probably the biggest ARP venture that I've done recently, in terms of every sound except the robot vocals is made on the ARP. All the drum sounds, the bass, the ongoing sort of ostinato pattern stuff, and the melody instruments, the hi-hats, and each individual track is imaged in 3D sound, so that you're basically in the middle of a giant sort of seething broth of ARPness. So check it out, you'll get it. You'll know what I'm talking about when you hear the tune, the Higgs Field.
So before we end, I'd just like to say thank you very much for the interview. It was awesome.
Hey, my pleasure.
Not everyone loved the ARP 2600, so we sent Adam Ping out to interview Toronto sound designer Bill Mather about his experiences.
So joining me now is Bill Mather.
Hey.
How you doing, Bill?
Good.
First one to ask you was if you can give us a rundown of what it is that you do.
Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I mainly do post audio, but I still compose scores for documentaries and films. I have a film that just premiered at all the major festivals that I wrote the score for, called The Rendezvous, for a Swiss company. Beyond that, I still work with virtual synths on a number of different things.
So we've come to know that you've previously owned an ARP 2600.
I did.
Which is the synthesizer that we're featuring in our episode mm-hmm. this week. Could you give us a rundown of your thoughts on the ARP? And
Yeah, I bought my ARP 2600 while I was still in high school. And I was doing a bunch of session work at the time. It was one of the new hot synths that came out.
Yeah.
When I first bought it, it was monophonic. I eventually was able to upgrade it so I could play two notes at a time, which was a big deal. I was so impressed when I could play two notes at a time. though it didn't work very well, frankly. The two-note thing never quite panned out. So
it's
most of the time,
a little bit spotty or something.
Yeah, so most of the time I used it in monophonic mode.
I see.
One of the big selling points of it was that, unlike my very first synth, which was a Moog with big, we're using patch cables to do everything.
Yeah.
You didn't need any patch cables. Everything was laid out in a very nice visual format, because it was stacked vertically. If you were playing in a gig or something, you could see it right in front of you. And also you could see the sound chain very easily, the way it went between the oscillators and the filters.
So layout was a little bit simpler, I guess.
Which was great.
Straightforward.
Things like even the Mini-Moog, for instance, you couldn't at a glance get as good an idea what was going on, because it was using rotary knobs.
I see.
By having the linear faders, you had a much more visual representation of what actually you were doing at any given time.
Okay.
As far as the bad things go, well, the first bad thing about it was they were infamous for overheating.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And when they overheat, they just wouldn't produce any noise. I was doing music for a Doug Henning magic show. He was a really famous magician from Canada, but this was in his early days when he was still getting known. And we were doing a live concert in front of about 5,000 people, and I was doing the music for his 15-minute act. You couldn't do everything just on one synth in those days, so you used pre-recorded backing tracks and you added the synth on top. We started the show. It was delayed about 15 or 20 minutes. I knew that there's a danger of the ARP overheating, but you can't turn it off or you lose your tuning, all that stuff. So hoping that it would stand out. The very first thing that was supposed to happen in the show was I was supposed to do this giant swish noise on the synth that led into the pre-recorded tracks.
Okay.
Not a sound. So when I didn't do the introduction, Doug didn't come out, thankfully. And we actually had to stop the show for 15 minutes while I let it cool down and then retune.
Right.
So it wasn't big on my list. Very few people were trying to use it live, though. It was mostly in studios and things. Second thing about it, it had a very sort of thin synthesizer sound.
Okay.
Compared to something like the Mini Moog, it didn't have that big bottom end. It was sort of reedy sound. It was good if you wanted that sort of reedy sound, but if you wanted to have that sort of ballsy bass sort of sound, it couldn't produce it.
It wasn't up to the task, I guess.
It wasn't up to the task. Yeah. The third thing about the Mini or the ARP 2600 was, no matter what you did, it really didn't have a wide vocabulary of sounds, you know? Mm-hmm. You could hear, if you heard a record, you could hear it a million miles away.
Sure.
So it was a distinctive sound, which is good, but to use as a tool every day,
maybe still a little bit limited in its
everything
functionality.
Sort of sounded the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. You didn't have a real wide range of sounds.
I see.
Fourth thing about it was that with the sliders, they weren't precise enough that you could do total repeatability. What everybody used to try to do was put masking tape on the side of the faders, put a little mark, you know, for song one, for song two,
okay,
for song three, and then just sort of move to the things. Well, unfortunately, the faders weren't that accurate, so you never got quite what you thought you were getting. So repeatability was a huge issue with them.
So did it all kind of come to a head and, you know, at some point you were just saying, I got to get rid of this thing?
By first year university, so maybe I owned it a year and a half, I was using it as my headboard at university. I think I kept it around for another 2 or 3 years, just
as
sitting
a prop
in the box. Yeah.
Yeah.
As my headboard. And then I sold it to somebody at Master's Workshop, which used to be a big recording studio in town, and I think they used it sort of in studio for a while. I don't know where it is today. It may be a scrap of junk by now.
Sure.
I don't know.
But now when you see these synths going for, you know, thousands of dollars in price, does that kind of...
I wish I'd kept it as a headboard, yeah.
Yeah.
There's several synths that I own. My philosophy was sort of, because they were coming along with new synths so quickly, my philosophy was sort of buy the synth for a project when the sounds were new, and then immediately sell it while it still had some value.
Okay.
So I didn't hold on to any of them very long. And there's actually a couple that I wish I had kept for a long period of time. One was called, what was the name of it? Super Jupiter.
Super Jupiter.
It was a great synth. And it was a rack mount one.
Okay.
It was when they finally went to rack mounts. I used it for Lorena McKennitt, and I used it for a bunch of stuff, sort of, I don't know what period that even is, but it was a great synth.
Yeah.
Had a lot of different sounds, was easy to set up, but they were all a nightmare to tune. And I have perfect pitch, so it drove me crazy.
I see.
Is that
a temperature thing?
You name it.
Yeah.
You know, you looked at it sideways, it'd go out of tune. All the early ones, tuning was just horrendous.
I see.
We would literally, in the studio, have to, if you were doing something like a synth solo,
mm-hmm,
you'd have to stop halfway through, retune it, then punch in.
Okay.
So, you know, as they warmed up, the pitch would change. As they cooled down, if the temperature in the studio changed.
It's a very tedious process.
Yeah.
Getting
I was so glad when they got to the modern synths. You know, for the most part, I don't miss those old synths at all because the tuning was just too much of a nightmare.
I see. So today you've just kind of made the transition fully to digital.
I'm much happier with a virtual, all those things, because the virtual ones stay in tune.
Yep.
They do have the character of the original. I don't think that the Mini Moog, for instance, virtual version even though it captures the sort of character of it, it doesn't really sound quite the same.
I see.
But it's still a very usable thing.
So, yeah, sure.
And I have lots of other synths that can fill in those kind of whatever is lacking.
So that you would need, yeah.
I don't miss that period whatsoever of synthesizer history. Other than I wish I'd held on a few of them to sell today.
Sure. They just appreciate in value, it seems nowadays.
I don't know what a 2600 is going for now, but I can't remember what I sold mine for, but not a lot of money.
All right, well, great. Thank you very much, Bill, for your time.
You're welcome. Thanks for asking me.
The Mini Moog was introduced in the early 70s, and ARP needed to come out with something just as portable and convenient for everybody. So they came out with the Odyssey. The ARP Odyssey had only two VCOs compared to the Mini Moog's three, which made the Mini Moog a little fatter. ARP released a lot of different versions of the Odyssey. There weren't a lot of huge changes within the decade from the 70s to the 80s. A lot of faceplate changes and, you know, really incremental things. One thing worth mentioning, though, is the model 2820, which came out in the early 80s. The faceplate of the 2820 really resembled the 2600, which was really popular amongst old-school ARP fans. They didn't make a lot of changes. They introduced XLR inputs and outputs. Because of the changes they made, the 2820 was one of the more popular models of the Odyssey. We sent Dan out to talk to our home slice, Peter Chapman, about the ARP Odyssey.
Okay, hey, Peter Chapman has been kind enough to lend us his time again and his drinks. Peter, you are going to tell us a little bit about the ARP Odyssey, which is the one that came after the ARP 2600. So what do you think? Why was this such an important player in the world of synthesis at the time?
Well, it was, as far as I know, it was sort of the direct competitor to the Mini, as far as I know. So you've basically got the Moog modular, and then you've got the Mini Moog, and then there was the ARP 2600. Actually, there's probably an even bigger modular ARP that I don't know about. But this was sort of the one that cornered the equivalent market.
The Mini Moog.
So it was, yeah, so it was like the portable ARP that you could...
Yeah, it's a lot smaller than the 2600. There's no extra part where you had to plug in stuff for a start.
Exactly.
It's a lot more user-friendly, I guess.
Yeah. Exactly.
Lovely stuff. So, like, sonically, it's up against the Mini Moog in a market. So, sonically, what could it do that the Mini Moog couldn't?
The modulation routings on it are a lot more intricate, so you can do some crazier stuff on it. The Mini, basically, all you could do is assign the third oscillator, the LFO, to the pitch or the filter. Whereas with 26, or with the audio... Did you say terrible?
It's awful. There's only two options.
I know. Whereas the Odyssey, you could modulate a lot of different things to a lot of different things and get a lot more far out sounds. And sonically, it was almost more of a lead synth, the Moogs were known for their bass and their sort of creamy sounds. The Odyssey was known to cut a lot more.
Sorry, I'm just laughing at creamy sounds.
Creamy, yeah, totally.
I mean, it sounds good, but, you know. Sorry, anyway, carry on. Something about the Odyssey.
Yeah, it was much more of a lead style synth.
Cool.
So yeah, so that was sort of, it was known to have a much more aggressive, aggressive sound. And it was also actually apparently at one point there were some lawsuits thrown back and forth between Moog and ARP. Regarding their filter, stepped ladder filter. I don't really know what that means.
I've always thought that the step ladder filter is kind of similar between the Moog and the ARP.
Well, you can get much higher frequencies with the ladder filter.
Exactly.
They go tall, climbing science.
Can you play your ARP for me?
Another thing that it can do, another thing it can do that the Moog can't do is it's got a sync function, which I really like. So you can sync the oscillators, which give you that like very sort of guitar-y, Daft Punk-y kind of sound. This particular one has some sketchy contacts, so that's why you get those funny wobbly notes.
I kind of like that, though. Maybe that just adds to it. Is that just...
There we go. Another cool thing about this particular ARP is it's got you can actually play two notes at a time. It's known as duophonic.
Duophonic?
Yeah. So that was a really big deal at the time. Unfortunately, it's not very... It doesn't work very well. What it is, since it is two oscillators, if you play one note, it'll play on both. If you play two notes, it'll split them between the two notes. But it never really plays in tune.
Oh, that's some... It just sounds like Mega Man after a while.
Pretty much all synthesizers sound like Mega Man.
Oh, cool. Maybe that's why Mega Man was so successful. It really cornered that synth market.
Totally.
Yeah, so, I mean, so the duophonic thing, almost the best invention of all time.
Up until that point, for sure, totally.
It's pretty wild. So, is it, yeah.
The fleshlight hadn't been invented yet.
Oh, dear.
Just making you, giving you work to edit.
Yeah, thanks.
But up until the fleshlight, that was, in fact... No, it was cutting edge at the time. A competing company, a company called Octave, actually came out with a synth that was a total jack on the ARP.
Weird. Did they get in trouble for that?
Yeah, they did. Well, there were lawsuits thrown back and forth. I've read in some places that they sued them. I read in some places that the lawsuits were dropped. But it also, Octave was like a really cheap version of the Octave Cat. And
crumbs.
Totally.
Going on, Dan?
Oh, loads of stuff, Adam. Some pizza. It was pretty great.
Yeah, it was actually quite delicious.
I know, right?
I never... Who would have known that vegetarian pizza would taste that good?
Oh, you take the meat off, it's a whole little experience. Anyway, you were talking about ARPs.
I was talking about ARPs, actually, yeah. Specifically, we were talking about the executive committee of ARP Instruments.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, Alan Robert Perlman was the one who started the company. Mr. ARP.
You know me.
Yeah, yeah. And he, I mean, obviously we mentioned that Alan was an engineer by trade, but he wasn't particularly particularly versed in the business side of the business.
It's such a, like, pretty similar to Robert Moog again.
Yeah,
we keep finding these parallels.
Yeah.
It's pretty wild.
These science-y types that just don't know what they're doing when it comes to the actual
business.
Someone
needs to teach these physics nerds about numbers.
Seriously, right?
Right.
So he had a couple other guys that were helping him out with the company. This was Lewis Pollock was one such guy. He was headed up the legal counsel, and he was also the chairman of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And another younger guy that was, David Friend. He was this young genius that was fresh out of university, and he was... he had a background in engineering and music, but much like Perlman, he just didn't really have much. He wasn't very versed in business. You know
okay,
what I mean?
No savvy whatsoever.
So,
like lambs to the slaughter. The whole of the ARP company.
ARP is just, they're headed for trouble.
Oh dear. What sort of trouble, Adam?
And I mean, right from the get-go, ARP was kind of... They suffered from problems with capital. They were always underfunded. And, I mean, right in the beginning, they had to sell a bunch of shares in the company in order to generate enough money to finance the first developments of their instruments, right?
Right.
And it was this high amount of debt that meant that they were constantly struggling to balance their books and figure out, you know, what they needed to do to stay afloat. For whatever reason, it worked for them in the beginning with, like, the development of the 2600 and the Odyssey.
Yeah.
But, you know, later on, projects were just like they were just plagued with problems.
Oh dear.
For instance, it was what was it called?
The Avatar?
The ARP Avatar, that's the one. Yeah, exactly.
I heard about this. What was it?
So the Avatar was their attempt to create a synthesizer that was based on a guitar input rather than a keyboard input. So,
okay.
You know, with the previous instruments, with like the 2600 and the Odyssey, you'd have a keyboard that was controlling the voltage.
Right?
So what they wanted to do instead was have guitar control. But what this meant was they had to have a module that was converting pitch to voltage.
Oh, right. No.
Pitch to voltage control, right? And so one of the main drawbacks of the Avatar was that they couldn't accurately convert the pitch to voltage. What you ended up with was a voltage that it just wasn't clear enough, you know what I mean?
A funk of voltage.
A funk of voltage, yeah.
Terrible.
And that was just, I mean... So alongside the development of the Avatar, one of the things that happened was Perlman was just... He didn't see this... going very well, and he expressed his concern that, you know, I don't know if we should be going down this path of creating this Avatar. But essentially what happened was Pollock and Friend, they vetoed him, and they were just saying, you know what, we're going to go ahead with this anyways. And this led to a lot of infighting within the company. A lot of the mismanagement that was happening within ARP at the time would eventually lead to their demise. Nevertheless, they went ahead with the Avatar. At the time, you know, this was a company that was grossing about $7 million annually. They ended up sinking about $4 million into generating the inventory that they needed for the Avatar.
Disappointing.
Yeah, well, I mean, ultimately, I think they grossed like $1 million in sales on the Avatar, so it was a big failure the end. And Perlman was right.
Yeah. So ARP, the company, folded?
Not initially. I mean,
okay.
Right after the Avatar was introduced and kind of seen as a failure, they tried to save themselves by introducing a couple other instruments. They came out with one called... Oh, what was that? It was like the ARP Chroma or something like that.
Okay. And that like a synth thing?
Or it was another polyphonic synth, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, and so eventually it was sold off to Rhodes, and it did quite well for them in the end. I think they grossed about $3 million in sales on that keyboard alone, which was unfortunately too late for ARP. They had at that point they had already declared bankruptcy.
This is early '80s, right? This is like
about that time, yeah,
or something.
80-81, when it was really like they just didn't have enough cash flow, and because the company was dealing with so many issues with liquidity, they had to call it quits eventually, right?
Man. So yeah, I heard that, you know, like Perlman's still around, he's still alive and kicking, these days, not making musical products anymore. He's gone back to his more engineering, technical engineering kind of side.
Yeah.
He's making small electronic components for a small business. I think in somewhere like Connecticut or somewhere, you know, it's like Northeast America.
Yeah, I heard that his new company is just like 10 miles away from the original ARP factory or something like that.
All right, cool. The world of electronic music is really indebted to the contribution that Perlman and the ARP family has made to the evolution of synthesizers.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Your envelope has just been pushed. We want to thank Don Garbutt, Bill Mather, and Peter Chapman. You can check us out on Twitter at twitter.com/pushingtheADSR. Peace out, homies.
You want to hit me up later on the D floor. Add me as a friend on Facebook.
Yeah.
Send a request. Poke me. Don't be afraid to message. B-Man was bumping and grinding on the dance floor.
B-Man goes university.
Excuse me, I'm lost. Where do I find room 102?
Oh.
Can you direct me to the registrar's office? Oh my God. I have a schedule conflict.
Yeah. Oh my God.
I need to draw pottery 101.
Oh my God, that's so good. Did you record that at registrar's office? He's in a suit, get up.
Yeah. Tell me. Where are the other drugs?
Oh, that was pretty good.
That was unreal.